Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
When you were born, I spoke to you in Farsi almost naturally. Looking back now, you know, it was quite a pretty special thing because not having people to speak your mother tongue with was hard on a daily basis. Yeah, that's probably the only regret I've got when it comes to raising you guys. Yeah.
Kia ora, we're your hosts, Julie
and Sarade. We travelled around Aotearoa with our soundie Joey, meeting immigrant whānau, listening to stories and discovering what is said or not said between different generations.
These stories warmed our hearts and broke our hearts. And over this series, we invite you two to listen in on conversations with my immigrant parents. Welcome back to the first episode of Series 3 of Conversations with My Immigrant Parents.
We're back.
In this episode, we're in Tūranga Nui Akiwa with Adele, Maxine, their two kids Carmel and Hami, and their cat Gagush.
In the conversation is Dad Adele, who is Iranian, Mum Maxine, who is Samoan Chinese Māori, and daughter Carmel. The family lived in Tāmaki Makaurau for many years, but moved to Gisborne just before the first COVID lockdown of 2020, and now they live in Kaiti.
Ko Tainui, ko Hirotana Waka, ko Taupiri, ko Pukamoremore, ko Tisirangi ngā maunga, ko Waikato, ko Uawa, ngā awa, ko Waikato, ko Te Aitanga Hawati, ko Ngāti Ira, ngā iwi, ko Ngāti Hawa, ko Ngāti Wewehi, ko Ngāti Koruki, ko Ngāti Kahu, ko Ngāti Mahanga, ko Ngāti Mahuta, ngā hapū, no Tūranga Nui a Kiwa O, ko Carmel, Aroha, Salmanzade, Aho. My parents are Maxine Chan Salmanzade and my dad is Adil Salmanzade. So my dad was born in Tehran, Iran, and he was there until he was 15 years old, and then kind of after that, he and his brother had to escape Iran. They lived in Pakistan for 2 years, and my dad's been living in New Zealand for over 30 years now. And then my mum, her father migrated from Samoa. His father came from China. And my mum's mum, her mother was from Uawa. My dad's like very artistic and creative. Everything he does, he kind of just does in a creative way. My mum's a lot more practical, but then also like my mum's creative. So I don't know. I think they both balance each other out.
Carmel Aroha Salmanzade. I remember when I gave birth to her, she looked up at me and that was it. She held like this gaze and I thought, oh, that's a bit scary. How she looked me in the eye and I was like, you're my mum and what are you going to do about it?
Yeah, when I think about Carmel, I think she's taught us a lot about life as well. She has this perspective that's full of wisdom. She's very articulate, but of course, she's quite strong with her views about things she believes in. In 1979, the Iranian Revolution happened. It was increasing the persecutions of the members of the Baha'i faith, and it really changed our life. My dad was presented with either converting to Islam and keeping his job or remaining a Baha'i and losing his job. So that was the beginning of things not being the way it was for us before the revolution. It didn't leave any choice for my parents other than sending us overseas. At the time, there was thousands of Baha'is leaving through the borders with the help of people smugglers. And I remember we had passed the border with the camel.
Into Pakistan.
Yeah. We were thrown in the back of a ute, covered up. We were given local costumes. And I remember the car stopped. We were anxious too, so why the car stopped? And the smuggler came and said, "Do you want a Coke or a Fanta?" And I remember just be able to see there was absolutely no houses, no trees, nothing. For miles, it was just like desert.
Oh, my gosh.
But there was this kiosk in the middle of nowhere that had cold Fanta and Coke. And it was
cold.
Cold. So yeah. Because they had ice, you know, they had put it in the ice. But it was almost like
an oasis. For
thousands of dollars you had given them to smugglers. And you haven't been any food, you haven't had much to drink, you haven't had anything to eat for days. There's a cold Fanta just being opened up and being passed on to you, you know.
And oh my gosh, I feel like they would use that as like a commercial.
Yeah, so that's so that Fanta tasted incredible, amazing. I still have a... I sometimes buy Fanta to remember that moment.
We should have Fanta with dinner tonight. I feel like that's going to be a vibe.
We have to get Fanta tonight. Yeah, we had a unique situation where I had an older dad who realistically couldn't make it through the border, you know. Grandma came with us through that journey, stayed with us for a few months. Registered us with United Nations, and out of the thousands that escaped from Iran to Pakistan and gone to their countries, there was only maybe a few who actually did the return trip, and she was one of those people.
I think it makes me cry every time, even when I'd like just think about like myself, and sometimes when I'm like telling people about how you came here and stuff, it makes me cry. I remember being like 15 and thinking about it. I was like, imagine if I had to leave you guys like at that time. And I remember like, you know, I get to 16 and I was thinking, you know, I had one more year with my parents that you didn't have. And then like when I got to 17 and then 18, I was like, oh, there's a few more years that I've had with you guys that you didn't get to have with your parents and with your dad, you know, where you're from. Now be like almost 20, you know. I just feel so lucky that I have you guys. And you know, like, don't mean to make it about me, but it's just like the only way I can like kind of relate to your story, because it's so different from like the kind of privileges that I've had in my life is so different from the things that you had to go through.
Big decisions and big things that, you know, ordinary families don't have to face, you know, that you have to send your children away.
Yeah, like I'm moving back to Auckland where I have family and friends that I've known my whole life, but you were like, you went to Lower Hutt, like, you know. Like,
you ended up in Lower Hutt.
Yeah, and, you know, just even Harmy's like turning 17 soon, well, like the beginning of next year and...
Mm-hmm. It's good to be reminded. It's good to talk about it. You know, it's good to think about, you know, especially when you're mad at your dad.
Yeah. I remember, like, as a kid, like, whenever I was, like, angry at dad or anything and, like yelling at him stuff, I'm like, oh, my God, your dad's a refugee. You're, like, yelling at your refugee dad.
Yeah.
Like, he's already had it hard enough.
Yeah. Oh.
You never did it intentionally. It's just what you were going through. And
yeah, I think that's kind of interesting, actually. Like, you never made me feel like, you know, your life, your situation, like I couldn't live in my own struggle. Like, not that I was struggling, but, you know, there was things I was going through and I would, like, think is your fault, or I never felt like I couldn't complain about things.
No, they were real for you.
You see, I didn't have that as a 15-year-old, 16, 17-year-old. Then you're going through a hard time to talk to anyone. to be in a position for your child to go through a hard time made me feel useful that I'm there for you, even though I didn't have my parents to, you know, take my issues to. So your ability to feel like you could even be really upset and emotional, and for me to experience that, that was really, it was like having a normal experience. I wanted you to have a normal experience because my experience wasn't normal, yeah.
There's such a big difference in experience in childhood and teenagehood between father and daughter here, but there's still so much understanding on both sides.
It feels really healthy. I really like that his approach to parenting is almost like wanting rebellious kids. Like, he's so grateful that they didn't have to go through that traumatic experience that he did. So he loves when they're like, just like a quote-unquote normal teenager. There's almost like a trope that immigrant refugee parents come here to want and make a better life for their kids. And I really appreciate that. Part of that is wanting your kids to live kind of guilt-free. They don't need to hold on to that trauma that you had.
So because Adele's mother had to make the difficult choice to go back to Iran to take care of Adele's father, Adele and his brother spent 2 years in Pakistan with only each other and arrived in Aotearoa in the late 80s as two teenage boys alone again in another new country.
In this next part, Adele starts off remembering what it was like finding out New Zealand would accept him and his older brother as refugees.
I still have the letter from New Zealand Immigration Service. And the letter was, you have been accepted to New Zealand and you can enter New Zealand from any time from this date, you know. That was life-changing because for 2 years we were in complete limbo. And I remember seeing the old school Air New Zealand logo on the wing of the plane and never forget that color, you know, that teal color, and that logo is like, actually, I love the old one. I don't know what they turned it to black for, but that brings back such a strong memory of, I kind of associated that Air New Zealand logo to freedom. Didn't sunk in how far we are from everything until we arrived. And there was still excitement in the refugee center for 6 weeks in Mangaret. There was a sense of excitement, you know.
And you were 17.
I was 17.
And that, was that your, like, second trip in an airplane?
Second time.
So escape was like escaping around part of it.
To get to the border was my first time in a plane.
Yeah.
And my second time was getting out of Pakistan and arriving here, By 1990, really started sinking in, my God, we are so far from anyone we know, from our parents. And we had no passport. You see, we couldn't even travel. Trapped. Yeah, I think those early days, I think...
must have been really tough.
Being bullied at school was really hard, you know. Not speaking the language, not having parents. I think maybe I was 23, 24 when I really felt, okay, I know where I'm at, I know who I am to some extent. And I was on Ministry of Youth Affairs at the time, it's called. I was on their advisory as a representing refugees. This opportunity came to go to Japan to represent New Zealand as some Asia Pacific youth forum. I was one of the six delegates and I had a passport so I could go. Probably that's why I got the passport, maybe, my first big trip. And I remember arriving in Japan and being treated with so much respect and so much support. And Japanese were like, treat me exactly the same as the Maori delegate, as the Pakia delegate. We were all treated the same, you know? And I remember had such a wonderful time for like a couple of months in Japan. I really loved it. And then I came back. I arrived back in New Zealand. And I saw my six fellow delegates just one by one.
Walk through customs.
Walk through customs. And I could see them embracing their families and, you know, like leaving the airport gates in Wellington. I was approached to go to a room because they needed to ask me some questions. My you know, delegation leader is like coming to them and saying, oh, he's with us, you know, he's got a New Zealand passport, and it's mid-90s. So this is pre-September the 11th, but there was still a lot of sort of certain attitude towards Middle Easterns and, a bit of
suspicion
and stuff. And I remember being questioned about my passport and sitting in that room, a small room, a couple of border officers sort of asking me, just tell us how you got the passport, when did you come here, and all of those things. And and I remember one of them saying that, your name comes up in, as someone that we need to talk to, or you, they were making excuses. And I remember just telling them, look, I've just gone to Japan. I'm a New Zealander. I've got a passport. And that's my delegation leader. He can confirm that I was with them. And this is my background. I came as a refugee. And none of those really mattered to them.
Wow.
And for 2 hours, I still have a mental image of how each delegate member couldn't wait for me anymore, even though they felt quite concerned about why he's been held back. And one by one, they had to leave. And then the delegation leader said, look, I will contact the ministry and I'll see if I can sort something out. And I had left my car. So a friend had driven my car to pick me up.
Yeah.
And he was pacing back and forth, he didn't know what to do, and he was there. And so it just carried on, and it became this 2-hour thing. And I was like, I couldn't even speak. I was so stunned, like, this is really happening to me,
That would have been so humiliating.
And so I got into the car, and I was like, I couldn't talk to my friend, And I remember he wanted to get me home because I just saw, just get me home. I can't really talk. But I was sobbing.
Was it Wellington Airport? Yeah. It wasn't.
All the way from Wellington to Petone, where I lived, I was just uncontrollably just crying, sobbing. And and it was like... yeah, I think that was the moment. That was actually, it was a moment in many different sort of, for many different reasons, it was an important moment, because it was like, for the first time, I really experienced prejudice.
Yeah.
What I experienced in Iran as a religious minority didn't faze me. I could still get up, be proud of who I was.
Yeah.
For the first time, I thought my look, my name, regardless of how much I've done in the past 5-6 years, my education is just really nothing mattered.
Mm.
Only mattered that what I look like, what I sounded like, my name. I was just another Middle Eastern who've been sort of racially profiled. Took me many, many months before I could trust New Zealand and system, and New Zealanders. And
yeah, I'm so sorry that happened to you.
Yeah, so obviously still very raw.
I haven't been able to stop thinking about it since we heard it.
And I think you can completely hear how big of an impact it has had on Adele, that he remembers it so vividly, like decades later. You see the image of those people leaving one by one as he describes it.
Mm-hmm. It's like Adele just got dropped into this other version of racism that is so prevalent here, which is that if you're other, you're part of a total wash. And I can see why that's so gross and upsetting.
And I guess interesting also how he compares it to persecution in Iran and why this felt worse, because I guess you're sold the story that New Zealand has such good race relations, it's such a safe place to be, and this was a moment where it really wasn't. And the fact that he really saw New Zealand as this symbol of freedom at one point in his life, and then to have that betrayal, really. So Carmel and Maxine had somewhat similar experiences in that they both grew up with immigrant dads. Maxine starts off this next part remembering what it was like being from a Samoan Chinese Māori family. Just a warning, this section contains some offensive language.
Growing up in your own family, that's your norm. Mm. So my norm was grandma too being Māori and dad being Samoan Chinese. That was my norm. Mm. So that's what I thought. Every family was like that. You know, when I think about you and dad, there's so many similarities like between me and my dad too, because we see things more than we realise as Kiwi. The dominant culture is kind of like so ingrained because it's the majority. For me anyway, when I was growing up.
I feel like I really don't identify with Kiwi.
Yeah.
I don't know why. It makes me like, it's just like gross or something. Like it's just, I feel like Kiwis are Māori word, but it doesn't feel Māori to me.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like it's been real like colonized. Like I only ever hear Pākehā say, you know, we're Kiwi or like.
Yeah. Or new migrants because they want to be.
Or because like Pākehā say to them, oh, you're a Kiwi
too. You're a Kiwi, When Dad came over, it was the end of the 60s and there was a lot of prejudice towards Pacific Islanders. Mm-hmm. And that was a big thing for my dad. Like, he just wanted to get on with things, speak English really well. Because a couple of things I do remember really clearly were, like, really sad. Like, go to the pub to have a drink, and the next thing you know, you're in a fight because somebody called you a bonga or a coconut or told you to go home because you were getting targeted for being not only an islander, but, look, you know, looking like a Chinese islander.
Did you notice that? Like, that there were people, Māori, first of all, who were tongues whenua, like from this land, treated differently, and then also just other brown people from neighbouring islands.
Right from get-go, I started sensing that there was divisions and disparities. The more and more I looked into it, well, racism was right at the core of it.
Would you say colonisation too?
Colonisation followed by racism. And it was that kind of thing that I felt like, I really, really felt that this lack of understanding about the impact of colonization in this country by general population. Mm. And it was like, oh, we've dealt with it. We've moved on, you know.
I think, obviously you always knew I was Māori, but I don't really remember, like, fully.
I knew you were Māori.
Thinking about it as much as I do now.
Yeah.
Or, like, but when I was starting high school, and I was choosing a language. I think I had chosen, like, Spanish, then French or something like that.
Yeah, no, remember I was and trying then, to tell you, please choose Māori or some, or at least in your languages.
You and I think it was good hearing it from you, but I remember Dad also saying to you, you know,
supporting that.
Māori should be your first choice. Like, obviously, you know, Mum would support it, but, like, you know, having you who's, like, not Māori.
As a Tōiwi dad, you know, I feel a sense of responsibility, really, that I've benefited from this country in all kinds of ways. People from refugee backgrounds come here and really enjoy everything that New Zealand has to offer without understanding, well, some do, but many don't, that actually we have an indigenous population here who are still challenged by a system where they're struggling in education, health, housing. If you think about colonization as an earthquake that really caused so much upheaval for Māori, we live in Kaiti, which is like the epicenter.
Yeah, literally where James Cook, like, landed. For me, it's like, I think also for Mum, it's really special because for the first time ever living in a place where we're actually, like, from, because I know I might never be able to go to, like, Iran, which is, like, half of me. Even moving here has made me feel more connected to, like, Iran in a weird way because it's, like, the first time being somewhere where you're really from. And then so it's just, like, can kind of imagine, like, what would it feel like if we lived in Iran?
Yeah, I know what you're saying. Like, if I use the analogy of for 35 years I've been in a pot plant, I've been this little tree little pomegranate tree in a pot plant that's gone from one house to another house. And for the first time, I feel like I've actually taken the little pomegranate tree and I've planted it in this house in Kaiti. And I kind of feel like, oh, we've got roots here.
Yeah.
I just love that image.
Such a great image.
And for Kamel, as someone who is both tangata whenua but also someone from a refugee background, like having both an inherent belonging to this whenua while being displaced from another place, like I think that's such an interesting juxtaposition that people don't consider a lot maybe when from both those communities, I guess, but special that she feels like she can find a new sense of connection to Iran even just being back closer to her whakapapa in Tauranga.
I felt like such a sense of loss that I will never experience being in the place that I'm from in that way. I think that being around people who are really honouring themselves and their whakapapa in the way they talk and the way they eat, the way they dress, the way they love, makes me feel like I have the courage to do it too. Like it's easy to be around people like that because you feel like you can bring your whole self to the table as well.
Yeah, yeah, I love that.
In this next part, we hear about how Maxine and Ardell met.
So we met at the refugee centre.
Romantic.
But Mom doesn't remember.
I don't remember meeting Dad.
But I remember her, which is...
Do you actually remember seeing Mom? Like, actually remember.
Dad says that. Yeah.
And I had amazing hair. I definitely looked across and made a mental note that I'm going to meet this girl again.
Yeah.
In fact, without exaggerating, I remember saying, oh, I want to marry someone like her, you know. I had no English, so there was...
So how did you say it in Farsi?
In my head, I would say something like, you know, Zane Hamsar, or Zane Ayande Man. Yeah, I'm saying she's... But it's all in my head.
Mental note.
Your
mental
note. Dialogue.
And then we lost touch. We never been in touch.
It was all in your mind.
Never in touch to lose touch. So that was a.
The song. You can't touch.
And
this.
I remember. Yeah, there was this pamphlet about the Baha'i faith, and then I opened it up, and then here she is. You know. There were no Facebook or social media or emails.
No Insta.
Or nothing.
No Snapchat.
The only way to find out
no Twitter.
Where someone's at, like, I knew that she was a Baha'i.
Yeah.
So I wrote to our national office, which they have everyone's name and numbers.
Oh, my God.
I said, oh, I'd like to have this person's number and, you know. And
this they was gave before it that, to you? This was before the privacy policy the kicked in.
And they gave, oh my gosh.
Yeah, there was a couple of other people too that I wanted to get in touch with, but of course the excuse was...
Get in touch with them the same way you wanted to get in touch with Mom?
No.
Okay.
But if I added two more names to it, it wouldn't have become obvious that wanted to get...
So you saw the pamphlet... Yeah. And you got her contact.
So then I get this letter from this person I'd never heard of before. And I remember thinking, who is this person? And I was a little bit suspicious, to be honest. I had as many Persian friends as I needed, so I didn't want to have another Persian. No, just kidding.
Oh, God.
I would file that letter.
No, I just thought, oh.
Fireplace.
And honestly, it was in those days people wrote to each other. So if you can... Head around that, it was like pen friends kind of stuff. And we probably have like a good 100 letters or so between us, which is quite lovely.
When the time comes that we finally actually meet face to face, it was really special. We had written so much by then that we've already like we were...
Felt like we really knew
each other.
Yeah.
Then I asked her to like, you know...
Would you consider marrying
together,
me?
You know?
Sort of thing.
That same trip?
Same trip. First date. First official date.
Okay. And 3 months later, we were married.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. And my parents were just granted. Something really amazing happened. With the persecution of the Baha'is, we were not allowed to have passports. Around mid-90s, they relaxed the rules and they let older Baha'is over the age of 70 to get passports. You know, they felt sorry for them, said they want to go and see their families. And
it's
so
kind of like a PR kind of exercise.
So like we're look not how really we are keeping the Baha'is from
seeing
their
families. Not stopping Baha'is leaving, but they were. But this was one way of showing.
Yeah.
That was really amazing. So that happened in 1997 that we applied for my parents to get visitor's visas. So it was a 6 months visitor's visa. We squeezed in
everything.
We squeezed in, deciding to get married.
A lot of celebrations.
Engagement, graduation, and then getting married in September the 26th of the same year. So that 6 months was just full on.
Yeah.
But on top of that, Grandpa was really sick. But I remember mom saying that from the time you guys left Iran, he just prayed just to see us one more time. He never prayed that, oh, I want to move to New Zealand and be with my kids. He just said, I want to see my kids, and then I'm happy to leave this earth. September, October 1998, we had to say goodbye to them, you know.
Was there, like, no way they could have just stayed, like, been able to apply for something?
Because they'd come on a visitor's visa and they had to go back.
The conversation came up, of course, you know. My dad was adamant that he doesn't want to die in a strange country. I would have liked him to pass away here. It would have been really nice to take you guys somewhere for his anniversary. You go to his grave. You know, that would have been nice for us, but for him... And it turned out also for my mom, because my mom didn't want to move here. And having his gravesite in Iran has been a source of comfort for her. When you are a refugee and your loved ones die one by one, you can really feel down. You can really feel disconnected. But I think having that belief that they are, it's just their bodies have passed on, but the spirit is all around you. It really helps to get through life as a refugee for me, as someone who's, you know, displaced.
I can imagine that'd be really sad not to go to your own dad's funeral.
Oh, yeah. That's really actually probably took me a good 10 years. Not his death, I think.
Because it was a relief, his passing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, his death, his release, being released from the suffering was like a joyful thing. But not being there to
help, support your mom.
Help my mom. And
help him even just physically,
I think those are the things that it's hard to ever fully heal from it. Yeah, I think the sadness is for him not to
see you guys,
meet you guys, and he would be so proud, and that would have given him a lot of joy. Yeah, when I think about his struggles, I think even mom and I getting married, that was like a source of achievement or healing for him, for all the suffering, because we didn't see each other, you know, from 1987 to
98.
So that was a good, I don't know,
11 years.
10,
11 years of not seeing your only kids. When you were born, I spoke to you in Farsi almost naturally, you know. I was doing my master's at the time and I had a lot of time. Looking back now, you know, it was quite a really special thing, because not having people to speak your mother tongue with was hard on a daily basis.
But
that's probably only regret I've got when it comes to raising you guys.
I'm sorry, we keep feeling bad about it sometimes.
Not continuing.
You remember how I always used to tell you to speak Farsi with kids?
I mean, I think at some point I was just wanted to talk to you guys.
And just, it was harder to switch.
It was just like, just wanted to talk. And I've never said, oh, we have to hang out with Persians or Samoans or Maori. We have all kinds of people coming through and friends. And I was happy to just sort of be a Persian, but not our life becomes about being Persian and the language and the culture. Mm. We took all the good, you know. All
He's
the
been
good.
Saving it up for now, so we just hear Persian music like 24/7.
Yeah. Which is really nice, though. It's really cute. Like you just listening.
We name our cat Gagoosh.
it's cute though. I like it. But it's funny because like I give you a hard time about not speaking Farsi to us enough. But like whenever people say, "Oh, why doesn't your dad speak Farsi? Like, why didn't he teach you and stuff?" I'd get so defensive and be like. I'd think it's so rude, like, because, you know, people don't really take into consideration, like, our situation. Like, you know, mum doesn't speak Farsi fluently.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, she speaks more than me. But, you know, it's just, like, it's hard.
Unfortunately, it's hard to do justice with someone Farsi and Maori. I said it would be very challenging, but you got to go with the one that's really... nurture you and you have community around you. And I think naturally it's Te Reo Māori, isn't it?
Yeah, like I understand that because I live here, it's important to me to speak Māori.
Yeah.
But I think also I really want to be able to understand Farsi. Because, and, you know, half of my family is Persian. So there's so many things I wish I could talk about with grandma. And I know it's not your fault, but it's just sometimes it's... hard for me because I feel really connected to her because we share the same faith. I'm learning kind of the same thing she learned, but in a different language. It would be so nice instead of like getting you to
get it second hand and with the bits that you miss out.
She could just tell me it.
As you go through life, I felt I had to sacrifice. You can meet new personal goals and new legacies. It's never too late. Like. I've got a very clear vision of speaking Farsi to your kids.
Oh, have I? Just let it out, Dad. Get it out. Don't try to suck it up.
I also imagine that too, so that'd be really nice.
There's some regret, there's some sense of this empty feeling. And I think the more you continue with your Te Reo journey, you'll satisfy some of that feeling of emptiness. But as Māori, you have responsibility to contribute to your people, right? Mm. If you lived in Iran, you would have a responsibility to contribute to Iranian people.
This loneliness that Adele expresses, I just really feel for that.
Mm.
Language isn't just like the words we say, is it? There's so much involved in a specific
culture
language.
And community as well.
Yeah. And to not be able to share that with your child, I can see how that would be really devastating.
I also just really love how deeply emotional the whole podcast recording was, and I love that they sit in their emotions as a family and just let that flow.
Maxine encouraging that too.
Just let it out.
Really so nice to hear. So Adele used to work more in social and community-based work with refugee and migrant communities, but he's also always been an artist and the entire family is really creative too. And Carmel is about to move back to Tāmaki to start at art school. In this next part, Adele talks about how he felt like he had to put his art on hold when he was younger.
For someone who was always saw myself as an artist, there was no way I was going to own a house in a time that I wanted to and have the financial resources as a refugee to have a comfortable life. I didn't give up everything, but I did give up art or a life in art over financial security.
Mm.
I think at least in the past 2 or 3 years, you've really grown as an artist. And it gives me a lot of joy that you don't have to think about what I was thinking about. At 20, the goal was to get some education and get a job, right? And you're 20 now.
Almost 20.
And the goal...
And I'm like, maybe I'll go to art school or maybe I'll...
and if you told me you want to do this degree because you want to have a job in 5 years, deep down inside, knowing you are an artist, I would be feeling really disappointed in my...
No
I
pressure.
I wouldn't tell you, but I'll be disappointed that, oh, she's basically... doing what I did, and I wasn't happy. Like, doing it, you know. So your journey in art is almost like makes up for what I couldn't do. But you
pressure.
No, you decided to go to art school.
Again, living through you.
Yeah.
You came to us and say, oh, I want to study like international something or law or something. Yeah. But you also like art.
Yeah.
You like film.
You want to pursue your Māori studies.
You like film and script writing. So we actually, at that point, you came to us. I basically said, you're not going to enjoy law. I can tell you now. I was very clear that you're not going to enjoy it. I knew you can do it.
It's funny because, I mean, like maybe I could have done it, but I think the reason why I was drawn to it was because of the work that you did with refugees and migrants. And
now that you're 19, you could still do law.
Yeah, Mum really wants me to do law.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think it was about what pathway we're going to use. And to advocate for people that we want to advocate, because you're not doing art because you want to satisfy your sort of ego and you want to do it to serve humanity.
And you really showed me that, because you'd be doing, maybe giving a talk or something at the refugee center, like, but then you'd also be just like selling prints for like a fundraiser for like a refugee family, or, you know, what happened with the shooting at the mosque and things like that. So I think I always saw that the way that you used art in that kind of social
spaces,
those spaces, because like I feel like I've only really discovered the art world in like the past year, because I've like started to work with people and spend time with people who are like involved with that. But my idea of like being an artist was you. It was.
I feel like my heart grew when I heard Carmel say that. I also really like what Adele says about we use our tools and we use the pathway that we can to advocate for people.
It's like we need all of it. We need the artists doing that. We need the community and social workers doing that. Mm. We just need that from all facets.
And what we are doing here in the podcast is a form of that as well. We're from migrant backgrounds and these are the sort of stories we want to hear. And that is true.
Yeah.
But also this is directly a response to white supremacy and the problems that we see here.
Yeah.
And the way that we are trying to contribute to the conversation is just by shifting focus, right?
Totally.
Home has always been where your dad is for me.
Actually, that makes sense, because when, like, people, like, ask me about you guys, like, separately, I always think of you guys the same. And I don't know if it's just because, like, when I came into this world, you guys were together. I can't imagine you guys as, like, separate people, like, living without each other sort of thing.
We've kind of had a bit of a nomad, sort of displaced, unsettled feeling all through my life as a refugee and beyond. So I totally agree with Mom. It's like wherever she is, whenever I am, that's home. We will never impose our concept of home on you. But deep down inside, we do like you guys to be close. As a small family, is that dream of being together again at some point and make somewhere home.
Mm.
Could be here, it could be somewhere else. Yeah, that's home for me, really.
I'd never been to Gisborne until we visited that first time, like a few months before we moved. I think purely because you guys were here, I felt home. But then also because I know that I fuck a papa here, like I felt home in that way too. Yeah, I don't know if I found exactly the place, like the physical place where it's like home. I imagine I'd like to live somewhere that my kids can go to, like a kura kaupapa or something. Mm. That's what I would really like to do, but yeah, who knows? I don't know, but I feel at home here.
What a great way to start our third season.
Incredible. So much emotion, such beautiful storytelling, and we just want to say thank you so much to the family for not only sharing your stories and your time with us, but also having us stay for three whole nights.
Cooking us beautiful Persian food. Gugush sat on Julie's lap for like a whole night, which really hurt me.
Thank you for teaching us to make art prints that we got to take home. We had such a great experience. So E mihi ana ki a koutou me te nui o a koutou, manaaki ki a mātou, ka nui te mihi.
You can check out photos and videos of all our families on Facebook at Where Are You From Really, on Instagram at Convos With Mai, online at tahi.fm or rnz.co.nz/conversations, or follow the podcast on all major podcast providers. Conversations with My Immigrant Parents was created, produced and directed by Julie Tool and Sarai De Silva. If you wish, you can follow us at Sarai De Silva or at Julie Tool with two U's. Location recording by Joey Siasoko. Sound post-production by Emmy Pagoni. Music composed and produced by Tal, Shantani and Shalina Sandrin. And videos are edited by Josh Yong.
Our cover image is illustrated by Ngā Mutani Jones and designed by Sonia Milford. A big mihi also to Tim Burnell and Jodie Huani from RNZ Commissioning. Conversations with My Immigrant Parents was made possible with the support of New Zealand On Air. He kōnei ipurangi tēnei mā te reo irirangi o Aotearoa.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.